This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel like
the term worldview, which I think is pretty pervasive now amongst Christians, that Christianity is not just a way of getting a relationship with God, but it's a way of looking at everything in the world. That's what a worldview means. In other words, my Christianity affects the way I see everything, absolutely everything. But the word worldview is a kind of philosophical term. I'd like to show you that a worldview is actually an understanding of what is the world's story. A worldview is the basic convictions you have about what is the world story, what is the world about, what is human life about, narratively speaking. So let me show you what I mean by that. I'm going to take about 25 minutes, I think, if you can sit here that long, and go through much of this, but not all of it. Look at point one. I've got 5 points to make. Point one is, you can't make any sense of any fact without placing it into some kind of narrative structure or story. This is the reason why I'm about to say it not only fits for fiction writers, but for journalists or reporters or anybody that's writing on anything. You can't make sense of a fact without putting it in some kind of narrative structure, putting it into a story. It's the consensus of a remarkable amount of study across both the liberal and the conservative spectrum in the last 20 years that this is the case. That you really on the conservative side, you have a guy like Alistair MacIntyre, who's a Catholic philosopher, who had written a book, very very important book, called After Virtue, in which he says you can't teach moral values in a classroom by saying, okay, we're going to teach honesty, we're going to teach justice and things like that. He says traditionally, moral character was imparted through stories of heroes or stories. Basically, you can't. You have to draw somebody into a story if they're going to understand a particular virtue. That's his whole book is about, the fact that of that. But on the other hand, of course, on the liberal side, there's a whole lot of talk about this. So, anyway, let me give you an example. Now, I think I may have mentioned this the first time we met, when there was about 12 of us or so. Oh no! First of all, what's a story? Which is actually, we have to fix that. We will soon. There's a debate about this, but here's my working definition. It's in the middle of the page. Little Red Riding Hood took her grandmother some goodies is not a story. Little Red Riding Hood was going to her grandmother to bring her some goodies, but a big bad wolf tried to eat her. That's a story. Why? Because you have at least these three elements. You have a movement toward a goal that we think is a good goal to get to. It's a meaningful end. We can call that the mission. There's some barrier or problem that gets between you and the goal. That's called the plot thickening. But anyway, there's a barrier between you and the goal that needs to be resolved. So Little Red Riding Hood was taking her grandmother goodies is not a story, but a big bad wolf wants to eat her, that is. And then you have protagonists and antagonists. You have anti-agonists, people who are agonizing away from the good goal. You have protagonists who are agonizing toward the goal. You have some people who are in favor and some against, and so you have good guys and bad guys, as it were. Now, here's an example of having, you can't make sense of 9/11 without putting in a narrative structure. I think I may have talked about this last time, but here's a great example. Everybody who talked about 9/11 had put it in a narrative structure, and here's three, the ones that are common. Narrative one, America's sins are finally coming home to it. America is the antagonist, the world's oppressed are the protagonists, and, there it is. And there's both conservative and liberal versions of that. The second narrative is, we're the good people and they're the evil people. We're good because we're the place where people have freedom, and they're evil because they're violent and they oppress people, and there's both a liberal and conservative version of that. Then there is the most nuanced of the three narrative structures you can put this in, and that is, this is the one that Giuliani and Pataki used so effectively, that through all this death, there can be a resurrection. We can be a stronger city. We can be better people. We can get through this. We can lick this. And the reason I put that down is probably a superior one is because despite the horror, you know, this is the story, despite the horror, we can become a better city than we were before. We can become a better country than we were before. We can be humbler as Americans, yet prouder to be Americans. There's all kinds of spins on it. The destruction, then, is as much the antagonist as the terrorists. And the victory is not simply military, but it's much more complex, it's much more spiritual, and it's actually more of a gospel approach. Because, well, we'll get to that in a minute. Because the third narrative doesn't demonize and idolize as much as the first two do. But we'll get there. But anyway, you see, everybody had to have a you had to spin on a story, or you couldn't even talk about 9/11. So my first point is you can't make sense of a fact without placing it in a story. Even if you're just reporting, there's the story there. You say, I'm just telling you the facts, but you can't tell the facts without a story. Second point, ready? You can't even tell a story. In other words, you have to put a fact in a story to make sense of it, but you can't tell that story without putting it in the context of a macro story or a worldview. Every story you tell is a subplot in a bigger story in your mind somehow, or in your heart, or in your soul, or somehow. Now, underneath the storyline of your immediate story, you have a macro storyline. This is a worldview. You can't write anything without some assumptions about the world story. What is the world story now? What do I mean by that? Well, think of these three pieces again. You have to, if you ask the question, what is life about? What is, as a human being, what should I be doing in life? What is my role here? What is the goal of a human life? Say, that's the mission. Then secondly, what is really wrong with us? I'll show you something here, if I have it. Yeah. What is really wrong with us? If there's something wrong with the world, what's the problem? Why is the world really not the way it ought to be? What's wrong? And then the third question is, who are the forces for good in the world and the forces that are hurtful? What should we do to fix it? And who's against the fix? Yeah, a perfect example of this is, it's been out of print for years. It's not a Christian book, but this is a kind of a college book called Seven Theories of Human Nature. Just looking at, this has been out of print for a while, since the mid-80s. Plato, Christianity, Marx, Freud, Sartre, Skinner, and Lorenz. And what the guy simply did was, he said, if you want to understand a worldview, he took every one of them, he said, what is their theory of the universe, what the world's here for? Secondly, what's wrong with human beings? And thirdly, how do you fix it? If you ask those three questions, you immediately throw, you know, the underlying worldview, which is their conviction of what is the world story, what is human beings here for, what is wrong with us, and how do we fix it, and who's for the fix and who's against the fix, who are the good guys and the bad guys. That macro story line is impossible to avoid. You've got to have some working version of it. It may not be all that well worked out. You might, in some areas of your life, operate off of your parents' worldview, and in some other area you're working out of your real worldview. So I'm not saying people are consistent and coherent, but you can't work without one. You basically have to have some running version of answers to those questions. Now I turn over to Beck. Now, what's different about, at some future time, it would be fun to go into the kind of reigning world stories that are out there, and actually bring up any short story, any movie, any play, any book, and ask the question, what is the underlying worldview that this reflects? As writers, you need to be able to do that. And actually, I think it takes a lot of work to do that. And that's something that maybe you should be doing all the time, is taking, you know, if you, I don't know what form this network is going to take, but there ought to be regular opportunities to ask these kinds of worldviewish questions when you're looking at a movie or a play or a book or a piece of fiction or whatever. But if you want to understand the basic difference between the Christian worldview and all other worldviews, here it is. This is a quote from a philosopher. Don't ignore the first paragraph. Look at the second one. The difference in the worldview of Christianity and the others is this. The great danger is to single out some aspect of creation, God's good creation, and identify it rather than sin as the villain. Now, I'll give you examples. An error like this always conceives of the good-evil dichotomy as intrinsic to creation. Like there's something, well,
Never mind. I'll get back to this in a minute. So in the course of history, the thing that is considered what's really wrong has been identified by every different worldview in a different way. Here's some examples. Plato in Greek philosophy really basically believed it was the body in the material world which is the problem, and we needed to fix it by aspiring to the spiritual. Rousseau and Romanticism, and an awful lot of that is still here today, identified culture and structure as the evil, and just getting back to nature and finding your true self and finding your primordial feelings and letting them be expressed, that was the way to fix it. If it comes to Freud and psychodynamic psychology's authority figures, both in the society and in the family are the problem, and all of our problem is our difficult relationships with them and our need to be free from them. If you go to Marx, it's economic forces. Heidegger and a lot of the existentialists, technology and bureaucracy. And here's what Walter says. As far as I can tell, the Bible is absolutely unique in its rejection of all attempts to either demonize some part of creation as the root of all our problems, or idolize some part of creation as the solution. All other religions, all other philosophies, all other worldviews, in one way or another, fall into the trap of idolatry, failing to keep creation and fall distinct. In other words, what he means by this is, and actually, it's interesting, Flannery O'Connor in her book talks about this too, and I don't know, I know they didn't know each other. One was a Catholic, one is a Dutch Calvinist, but said the very same thing. He says, if you think that there is some part of God's creation that's intrinsically evil and some other part that's not, so reason is bad but emotions are good, or emotions is bad and reason is good, or, you are mistaking creation and fall, because scripturally and biblically, God made everything good. He went around and looked at everything, kept saying, that's good, that's good, that's good, that's good. And at the very end, he says that he's very good. It's the only superlative. He looks at everything he made and it was very good. There's nothing intrinsically wrong. But when sin comes in, everything is messed up to some degree or another. Everything. There is no place where you find a savior in this world. The savior's outside the world. And there is no place here where you find the devil either, in created or in a created order. The problem is sin. Now, what does that mean? Look at my get back to my part of the outline. Compared to Christianity, all other views of reality identify some created thing as being the problem and some created thing as our hope, our salvation. And these are the protagonists and the antagonists of the worldview. Christianity says the answer to the first question is, what's wrong with the world? Sin. The answer to the second question is, what's the savior of the world? It's Jesus. Without the gospel, you have to make something besides the Lord into a savior, and something as the demonic other enemy. Now, what this means is, and this is hopefully liberating to you, I hope, Christians should be the absolutely most nuanced of cultural observers, trashing virtually nothing, and praising virtually nothing. It's like, wow. Not dividing the world into the good, okay, holy, safe part, and the bad, off-limits, prohibited part. Therefore, now everybody else does this. Everybody does this. Everybody else, compared to the gospel, is incredibly moralistic, no matter who they are. That's why Marxism assumes your problems come from the powerful, greedy capitalists who won't share the means of economic production with the people. That's the problem. So they're the bad guys. Solution is a state. Freud, on the other hand, believed all our problems come from repression of deep desires or pleasure. So you have authority figures, whether religious, and they're the bad guys. Solution is the unrepressed freedom of the individual. Okay, moral gatekeepers are the bad guys. Plenty of people, by the way, now here's what's interesting. A lot of people, probably real Christians, don't adopt a Christian worldview. They adopt a traditional values worldview. And the traditional values worldview, which is nothing but Freud turned inside out, they believe the problem with the world lies in bad, undisciplined, selfish people who won't submit to traditional moral values. See? And the solution is a moral revival. Get back to the roots of Western civilization. Make the family central again. Only the Christian worldview locates the problem with the world not in any one part of the world or any one group of people, but sin. Which means, sin infects us all. We can't divide the world into good guys and bad guys without understanding the nature of the kingdom. We're going to be naively utopian or cynical and disillusioned one with the other.
Yes.
Don't you want to use the Souls of Nietzsche quote here?
Oh, you mean that's famous. I mean, the line between good and evil goes down the middle of every heart.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, just to press on, I'm going to skip most of this middle part. But number three, what is the Christian storyline then?
Abby, turn on over.
Your Christian storyline has got three parts to it. Creation, fall, and redemption. Creation is everything is good. God made the world and everything in it good. There's no intrinsically evil parts of the world. Nothing is evil in the beginning. Even Sauron was not so, which is right out of Tolkien, of course. One of the shocks, you know, in if you're reading Lord of the Rings, is there's a place where the, you know, Elrond, the great wise, you know, elven lord, says nothing was evil in the beginning. Even Sauron was not so. You know, even the big dark, even he was good in the beginning. Everything has fallen from being good. That is a radically Christian. In fact, there is no worldview that allows for that. That is a radically Christian thing to say. And as a result, Christians can find the creational good, you might want to call it the creational substratum, good substratum in any culture. This is the reason why, you know, Tolkien could look at the old, you know, ancient Northern European pagan myths and find all kinds of neat good things, which he just was very happy to come and appropriate. There's a lot of Christians who don't operate out of a really biblical gospel Christian worldview, but instead out of traditionalism, and their whole idea is you can't have anything to do with paganism. It's got cooties. It'll jump on you.
Harry Potter will make you.
For example, yeah. But anyway, maybe Harry Potter's bad on other grounds, but not just simply because magic shows up in it. Number two, everything is fallen. Everything is fallen. There's no part of the world that's more affected by sin. And by the way, Calvinists believe in something called total depravity. And total depravity does not mean that everybody is as sinful as they could possibly be. That's ridiculous. Total depravity means that if sin was blue, everybody would be blue all over. Which is to say, your reason would not be less blue than your emotions. Your body would not be less blue than your spirit, you see. The normal day-to-day world would not be less blue than the church. So you just don't get romantic about it. Wouldn't it be wonderful to go into full-time Christian ministry and work with people who really love each other? Just don't think about that. Don't even go there. So everything is good, everything has fallen, and absolutely every part of creation is going to be redeemed by Jesus, soul and body, because he was resurrected. Now, what does this mean? Okay, let's start to work out the ramifications. This means that Christian writers can constantly deconstruct things with the gospel. There is a deconstruction tool. And the deconstruction tool is that if you make anything but God the center, anything but God the salvation, and therefore anything but sin the demon, it creates all kinds of problems. And there's an innumerable number of ways, both in fiction and nonfiction, to pull that out. That what makes life go wrong is not breaking the rules, though that's part of it, but making something besides Jesus your ultimate source of happiness. That's the tool. You can deconstruct religion. You can just show the problems with anything, conservative, liberal. Religious, irreligious, Christian, non-Christian, because inside all of those places, that's what's going on. There's the idolatry of moral people, the idolatry of immoral people. Now, you know, I do that all the time in the sermon, so if you come to Redeemer, you at least have an idea of how it's done. The postmodern deconstruction tool is a different one, and the postmodern deconstruction tool is everything is basically an exercise in power because there is no such thing as right and wrong. Everybody's just trying to get a leg up. The problem with that tool is it doesn't work. It's only fair if you use it on yourself. See, the Christian deconstruction tool can be used on yourself. You have to. You have to say, I'm doing it myself. I've got a problem too. The postmodern deconstruction tool does not work because as soon as you work it on yourself, it blows up. So, as an example, if, as Nietzsche says, all truth claims are really just power grabs, then so is his. So why listen to it? Start over. See, if, as Freud says, all views of God are really just psychological projections to deal with our guilt and insecurity, then so would his be. So why listen to it? Start all over. See, that it doesn't work because you can't use it back on yourself. But the Christian tool of seeing everything as some kind of as being tainted with sin works because you can work it on yourself. In fact, you wouldn't be a Christian if you hadn't done that. And as a Christian writer, you don't have to tell the whole gospel story every time to be a Christian writer. To simply show point two.
People don't have to come forward at the
end. No. To show point two. In fact, I'll show you. Just to show point two. Just to show the fallenness of things. Or just point one. Just to show the goodness of things. That's part of the line. It's part of the storyline. The macro gospel story is remarkably able to take in all sorts of mini stories. Now, I'm going to skip the next part because this is actually a piece out of Flannery O'Connor's book, Mystery and Manners, that shows this, but I want to rush to the end. So let's go all the way down to the bottom of page 4. Now, in fact, some of the questions came along this line because some of you were here last time and I said something about this. I believe it's very important to, especially if you're a fiction writer, but even no matter what kind of writer you are, there are certainly plenty of places and times in which, as a writer, you can come right out and do Christian writing. There's nothing wrong with that. Saying, I'm a Christian, and this is a self-consciously Christian piece of writing. But I don't think that's probably ordinarily what the culture needs. What they need is people writing on... In other words, another way to put it is, if you look at Jesus, you can write and say, oh, this is what I see about Jesus. And that's one form of Christian writing. But another form of Christian writing is to sort of use Jesus as your spectacles and look at the world. Now, it's one thing to look at Jesus, another thing to look at the world through Jesus, through what you know of Jesus. And that's really so that Jesus helps you make sense of the world, and so that when you're telling people about what you see, though you're not telling them all the reasons why you're able to make sense of it, they're able to say, yeah, that is interesting. That shows me something I hadn't seen before and draws them really closer to the truth. So what you want to do is you want to bury your storyline rather deep. You don't usually want to show it. I don't think that's hiding anything. The fact is, the difference generally is between the average non-Christian writer is that they have a worldview. They have a working version of this. And they aren't really aware of how unobjective they are, that they're, in a sense, always pushing their worldview in their writing. Sometimes there are some people that are self-consciously, got an agenda, but most of the time they don't know that, they don't see their own agenda at work. Christians should know it's there. You know your own agenda, but you also want to be careful. You want to be careful not to be, too pushy. But I see it's one thing when you're looking at Jesus and describing it. It's another thing when you're looking at the world through your understanding of Jesus. That's the kind of writing I think you want to do. Let me give you two examples of people that weren't very good at it. One was good. Like I said, this is the reason why Kathy's here, is because I haven't read... My fiction isn't very... I haven't read a lot of fiction. I read Tolkien and Lewis, of course, as you know. And one of the things I can tell you is, as a fiction writer, Lewis could not bury the storyline very deep. So if you look at his Space Trilogy, or you look at his Narnia Tales, it's just out there. It's banging you over the head. And as a fiction writer, I'm not sure really whether Lewis could possibly be the big... I mean, Jill was just saying, it's still astounding how much Lewis's titles sell, right? It's astonishing. But I don't think it's simply because of his fiction. I mean, I know the Narnia Tales...
Nonfiction.
Yeah, basically he built his reputation on his incredible ability as an essayist. And he's a terrific essay writer. But it just knocks you over the head. Now, as I said, what's interesting about Tolkien, if you think about it, Tolkien's writing project was to take the scraps of Anglo-Saxon Celtic myth and recreate a pre-modern mythology for England, like the German, Scandinavians, and Mediterranean Asian cultures had. Isn't that weird? Is that a Christian way of doing things? Well, he wanted to. It's something he wanted to do, but he wanted to do it as a Christian. In other words, he wanted to do something that he thought would make the world a better place. But he did it as a Christian, which is what I think writing's supposed to be. So, turn over here. The reason he was able to do it was because he had, and Catholics, by the way, are better at this than many Protestants, especially conservative Protestants. Catholics believe in something called natural law. Calvinistic Protestants believe in something called common grace, which is the same thing. Notice the difference. Calvinists believe if you know any truth at all, it's sheer grace. And anyway, it's a difference in a lot of things. But it's the same thing. They just use different names, and it tells you something about the different theology. But Tolkien actually believes, and I think he's right about this, he says that the gospel, he says, has hallowed all art. And this is the reason why. When you tell a great story in which there's a mission, there's a barrier to be resolved, nobody can see how the resolution's going to happen, and then it happens. That's a great story. If you can see it coming, I mean, there are stories, obviously, where you know what's going to happen at every point, you see it coming, And there are ways of writing that still get people to read it and make them weep only because they go directly for the emotions. And it's not a good story, but they just know how to push the buttons, you know. And nevertheless, Tolkien says, in a great story, no matter what your worldview, when you get caught up in the story and you feel like, yes, there's meaning in life, there is good, there is evil, there's something worth fighting for. Bernstein had this great quote where he said, Bernstein, of course, was an atheist and, you know, believed everything was an accident. But he used to say that when he listened to Beethoven's Fifth, he said, I get the feeling that there's something right in the universe. There's something that out there that follows its own laws, consistency, something that will never let us down. Which means is the art makes him realize that there really is meaning in life, though his intellectually, his primary, how do I say it? His secondary order belief, which is what he intellectually tells himself about the universe, says there is no God, it's meaningless. But good art gets at what Romans 1 says is everybody's primary first order belief, which is that we know that there's a God, we know that we're made in his image, we know some basic things, that we hold down the truth and unrighteousness. That's what it says in Romans 1. Good art gets at that. It flies underneath your intellectual beliefs and gets in and says, there is something, there is meaning in life. And of course, Tolkien's whole theology of this was that the gospel story is the story to which all other stories point. You've got the ultimate mission, you've got the ultimate, problem, which is how can, you know, mankind be saved. You've got the ultimate hero, the ultimate solution. And Tolkien really believes that whenever you just tell anybody a one heck of a good moving story, whether or not it's got Christian overtones, whether or not it has anything to do with God at all, and God's never mentioned at all in Lord of the Rings, it still moves people closer to the truth. So, you know, he just had this understanding of creational good. He saw that there's nothing in creation that's bad. He saw these great stories that moved him. He says, this is getting at the truth. You don't have to beat people over the head with them. And he never liked Lewis's fiction at all. None of it. Didn't like the space trilogy. He didn't like, because he says it's just too up there and out there. He says the storyline wasn't dug down there deep. Now one more thing, and I am done. This is the most radical thing, and I have to say it's getting close to what I do, and it's not exactly what you do. But there's one last thing to say. I've been trying to say, you can't make sense of a fact without putting in a story. You can't tell a story without putting it in a worldview. The Christian worldview actually is the most nuanced and actually the most friendly to all other stories. And this is my climactic point here. Ultimately, the Christian storyline does not have to evangelize people through head-on collision with the other worldviews. Gospel story is so great that it can kind of co-opt other worldviews. Now, I know that some people who are heresy hunters might think that what I just said was syncretistic, and it sounds like I'm saying that basically all truth is God's truth or something. No, that's not what I mean. What I mean is, take a look at what Paul does, and I'm going to give you an example. Paul, in 1 Corinthians 1, says, the Jews want power, but the cross is weakness. The whole idea of a crucified Messiah, that's ridiculous. Because the Jewish culture, that is the storyline of the at the heart of the Jewish culture, was all about power. He says the Greeks wanted wisdom, and they thought the cross was stupid because, you know, the cross was foolishness to them. When he says, you know that famous place in 1 Corinthians 1, he says the Jews wanted power and the Greeks wanted wisdom. What he's talking about is worldview. He says the Greeks didn't care that much about miracles and stuff like that. They were philosophers. They wanted reason. Give me your reasons why I should believe. The Jews don't. The Jews are not into philosophy. The Jews do not produce philosophy. They produce ethics. They're into power. You know, give me the strength. And he says what's interesting about Christian about the cross is the cross comes at every single storyline of every worldview and confronts it and says, he contradicts it. And yet, that's not the end of the verse. He says, he then turns around and says, but to those who believe, that the Jews and the Greeks, the cross is the power of God and the wisdom of God. In other words, it's a weakness and yet ultimately it's the true power. It's a foolishness, and yet ultimately it's a true wisdom. Listen carefully. What he's saying is, to believing Jews, the cross hit them as the ultimate power, not as the ultimate wisdom, because that wasn't their culture. To the believing Greeks, it hit them as the ultimate wisdom, not as the ultimate power. So what he's actually saying is the Christian story gets into the story of the culture and completes it. It doesn't just... It contradicts it, and yet it doesn't just destroy it. It completes it. Now, here's a perfect example. I put an example down here that doesn't have an explanation because I was just going to do this orally. The storyline of my parents' culture was the purpose of human life is to be good. That's what life's about, to be a good person. That's my parents. The storyline of my kids' culture is to be free. Kids don't come up saying, well, the important thing in life is to be good. The important thing in life is to be free, to find out who I am and do what I want to do. Now, the gospel presentation that I was taught when I was a young man to use on people was either the four spiritual laws or evangelism explosion or whatever. But if you know any of those gospel presentations, you'll know that they assume that the listener's storyline is the important thing in life is to be a good person. That's the mission. Because every one of those gospel presentations goes like this. You think the important thing is to be a good person, but you know what? I'm going to show you by looking at what the Bible says about how, you know, Jesus says that even though it's wrong to commit adultery, if you lust, you're really sinning, and it's wrong to kill, but if you're angry, it's sinning. So you find ways of trying to show people that they're not as good as they thought they were, that they really have broken the rules. And then they come in and say, but Jesus will make you good. So it enters into their storyline. The purpose of life is to be good, but you're really not good, but Jesus can forgive you and give you the power to live a good life. And that's how all those gospel presentations go. Try it on my kids' generation, who are in their early 20s. Doesn't work. Because they say, well, who's to say what is good? They say, who's to say what is good? So the gospel has to go into their culture. You can't just say, well, you idiots, you know, your trouble is you don't believe in absolute values. But absolute values are true. I mean, that's one way to do it.
So you say that a lot, actually.
You should believe the four spirit.
Right.
Now, here's what you do. I do this at Redeemer. I do this at Redeemer. I enter into the storyline of... Basically, I go like this. You say you're free, but you're really not free. See, with my parents, you have to say, you say you're good, but let me show you from the Bible that you're really not good. With my kids, you have to say, you say you're free, but you're living for something. And whatever you're living for is slaving you. Now, what am I doing? I'm defining sin differently, though it's biblical. Because, you know, in Romans 3, it says, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. But in Romans 6, it says, anyone who sins is a slave of sin. So, and besides that, as soon as I start to say, well, you know, it's wrong to commit adultery, you say it to my kids' generation, and say, well, who says? But what you can say is, if you make anything but Jesus the center of your life, you're setting up a master that can never forgive you and can never fulfill you. And I know this, that when I say to people, there's something in your life that you have centered your life on, and it's really kind of crushing you, you're having a lot of trouble meeting it, they know that. So if I define sin as building our identity on something besides God, they say, oh, really? That's interesting. And that's how Kierkegaard, by the way, and he was way ahead of his time because he was a proto-existentialist, in Sickness Unto Death, that's how he defines sin. So, but what am I doing at that point? I'm not changing the gospel. I am actually, I'm granting the validity, the creational goodness of the story. Yes, of course it's good to be free. I shouldn't look at them and say, you bunch of damn relativists. You know, why don't you believe in moral absolutes? Then I could preach the gospel the way I should be preaching the gospel. But see, that's just one way to preach the gospel. That's the way it entered into that story. You have to look at the stories that are out there that compete with the gospel, and instead of just clobbering them, cursing them out, enter in them, and show that really, because you believe that they're all basically good in some way, but also basically fallen, only Jesus will help your story have a happy ending. Only Jesus will really resolve your story. Because he's really the hero of heroes. And he's the hero of every world story, because really every world story, the Buddhist world story is right to a great degree. All suffering comes from the illusion that you're of the ego and of craving and putting yourself in the center. It's partly right. You see, I mean, none of these cultures have got wrong stories, and none of these philosophies are completely wrong either. And therefore, I would just like you to see
that Christianity tends to transform and resolve rather than simply oppose these other world stories. And your job as a writer is to show how that happens.
I'm a fiction writer, and I'm a fiction writer who supports myself and my family.
Yeah.
And basically, in my fiction writing, I tend to enter a lot of areas that a lot of Christians would find unseen to describe, but their reality. What's the difference between entering the darkness? I don't mean darkness like voodoo and stuff like that, but just, you know, the hard realities of life and some experience. What's the difference between indulging in those in a kind of worldly way and just showing what your characters are going through? I mean, like sex and, you know, messy life situation. Because I think that a lot of Christian writers tend to be mawkish.
Stay away.
Right, but now, see, I've tried to lay out here that the way I define a Christian worldview, there's no problem with going into it, right? And a lot of the people who are just afraid of even getting near there probably have more of a traditionalist worldview, and they have divided the world into, you know, they're sentimentalists, really, rather than Christians. And actually, if I skipped over those long quotes by Flannery O'Connor, read what she has to say. As you might guess, she feels that sentimentality, she calls it dualism. And dualism means you're dividing the world into the sacred and the profane, the good and the bad, as opposed to saying everything is creationally good and everything is fallen. That's what I'm trying to show you how to do. So there's no doubt about it that a lot in the Christian world would not want you to go there, and they won't buy your stuff. But that's all right. It's still a pretty small part of the world.
One of the questions here is actually sort of on the same line, so why don't I read that and answer it as long as we're on the subject. Should I read the question?
Yeah. Yeah.
In writing profiles, it is my responsibility to portray my subjects as they truly are, albeit on a slant and to the extent that one can be accurate when 1,000 choices are made regarding what to put in each piece and what to leave out. This sometimes means using quotes that contain bad language or telling stories that aren't always nice and pure. So far, I've only written for secular audiences. I feel that many who write for Christian audiences and many Christians who write for any audience believe that their work, fiction or nonfiction, must be highly pious, evangelical, or at least clean. That's sort of along the same
just way. Like life. Right?
The Bible tells true and real stories, leaving in the vicious and ugly details. Thus, I think an important issue is to be objective. How do such details function? For what purpose? The Bible also uses a degree of restraint. It's not explicit in our postmodern way. Most novelists today wouldn't write about newlyweds going into the bedchamber together without taking readers in with them for the whole ride. Would you talk about the overlap and divergences of truth, cleanliness, and restraint? Although every situation is different, there may be no hard and fast rules. How should Christian writers today think and make decisions about writing real human details and making scenes alive and true?
But don't translators of the Bible always struggle with issues of how to best, you know?
Absolutely, they do.
Yeah, it's usually more graphic than will fly. Yeah,
yes.
Even though this person's right in saying ancient writing was more terse. It wasn't as detailed. But, yeah, there's plenty of stuff in the Bible I don't have to go into right now.
One of the things about the Bible, though, is that God's showing us how bad we are. And so I'm not sure that's necessarily our style manual, because, it does go into some pretty graphic...
But now, why couldn't it...
Chopping up concubines and sending the pieces around, etc.
Which is what happened.
Well, right, and... But you can err on both sides of the equation. Most Christian fiction I stay away from, like the plague, because it is so ghastly. But on the other hand, I had a friend who wrote a novel of her conversion experience, and it was so graphic about the lifestyle she was leaving, it actually became a little tract on, gee, maybe I should try that before. You know, she was very explicit about this and that and this and that, and as I read it for her, and named us as Tim and I in the preface, I kept saying, gee, have I missed something? You know, it became more of a tract for that lifestyle than it was a testimony. I would recommend to you, as an example, to any of you who are thinking about this question, The Emperor of Ocean Park by Stephen Carter. He's a professor of law at Yale and just wrote a very well-reviewed first fictional book. He's done lots of nonfiction stuff. He's writes on politics. What are some of his titles?
Well, he's a law professor at Yale, so he's written...
The Culture of Disbelief
was the famous one, right?
The Descent of the Governed. Yeah. He wrote a very... I just finished reading it. Great book. Got very well reviewed. And he is not himself... He's a person struggling with his faith.
In the book.
Some of his characters are people of faith that he talks to, and they talk back to him in Christian terms. Others are people who despise that and think it's ridiculous. His marriage breaks up, and the advice he gets from the guy he's going to in marriage counseling is very Christian advice. Hey, you committed adultery with her together, so why shouldn't she think that's just fine to do serially now that you've got her? I mean, but none of it comes across... He just has a very light hand. His characters are not run-of-the-mill evangelical cookie-cutter characters, and his own main voice, the main voice of his main character, is a person struggling with faith, and it's not well resolved at the end. The marriage breaks up, he's sad, you know. I don't think I gave anything away by saying that. You can see it coming. But John Grisham's another example, if you want a popular one. He's a strong Christian believer, and yet he manages to always sell stuff. Now, you may take issue with the quality of his prose, but the thing is, he manages to get the stuff sold. I mean, people do buy it without having lurid, gratuitous sex and violence. And I am a big reader of mystery fiction, and I have found it more and more difficult as time goes by, because what used to be just a nice mystery story, whodunit, now has to have every few pages some abysmally gory description of violent chopping upness, and then a few pages later is some abysmally explicit sex scene, and it's just dropped in totally, not even connected to the plot. Just you can just see the guy saying sex scene here, you know.
Well, you know what though, that's, I mean,
yes,
obviously what I gave you tonight gets you away from just ruling out violent or sexual details per se. However,
The
slurpiness, like the Bridges of Madison County, you know. In other words, you can do an incredibly sentimental book. There's no sex or violence. I mean, there's no... Well, there is sex, but there's not. There's sex. But I'm trying to say... A minute ago, I was trying to say, if the real reason for either some real tearjerker, you know, moment... or some sexual moment, or some violent moment, is because the story itself isn't enough to really grab people. It's the story isn't good enough, that you've got to throw details in there that just kind of hit you in the gut. Then that's not good writing.
But I really would recommend you read the Emperor of Ocean Park, because he does a very fine job of hitting that balance as a believing man. He is a believing Christian. If you want to go back a few more decades, Dorothy Sayers' last Peter Wimsey book called Busman's Honeymoon, was a play first, then it was novelized. It's Peter Wimsey's honeymoon, and it's a very erotic book without seeing a single inch of, you know, naked flesh in the sort of thing. But it goes on Peter Wimsey's honeymoon without, you know, being gratuitous about it. So I think that what Tim was trying to say is it's a balance. You certainly do have to
put the
details in. It's not wrong per se, but it needs to be done with a clear conscience.
Well, also, watch your motives for it.
Yeah, your motives.
My guess is it's not going to be gratuitous if your motives are... it is going to be gratuitous if your motives is, I've got to do something that grabs people. I have to go direct for the emotion. Now, I know this is idealistic, maybe. Kathy and I know that when I'm not sure I like the overall sermon very much... In other words, if I don't feel like the overall theme of the sermon is grabbing people, then what you do is you start to
try to be the Holy Spirit.
Well, Kathy says you're trying to be. You start to yell a little bit more.
Well,
you
argument start weak, yell like hell.
Right, argument weak, yell like hell. I'm not sure the
you never
overall
learned that in journalism school.
I'm not sure the overall trajectory is strong. I'm not sure the basic preaching theme is grabbing people. So then what I'll do is you start to exhort. You say, this is really right. Christians should really do this. This is really important. And I realize that I can tell that the reason I'm kind of screaming about the details is because I don't think the overall
actually the story of the sermon, because the sermon has a story in it. It's got a plot and a resolution. You're not sure it's going to be resolved. That's how a good sermon works. And then at the end, Jesus shows up as a hero, and you couldn't see any way out, and then he shows up. It's the same thing as the story. If the story is great, but if I'm in the middle of the sermon and I realize, boy, you know, everybody knows how this is going to end, and even I know how it's going to end, and I don't think I'm grabbing anybody, then you just go after the details to try to go direct for the emotions, because I'm not sure I hit the heart. So I go direct for the emotions. I don't think the heart is the same thing as the emotions. The heart is sort of the center of the soul. And I think that's what, when sex and violence is gratuitous, people are just going after the emotions. They're just trying to grab people, and the story itself isn't strong enough, so watch your motives.
I just wanted to mention one other name. If you're a fan of mystery whodunits, this Margaret Mahron, M-A-R-O-N, she has two detectives. One is a Judge Deborah Knott, it's a pun, Judge Knott. And I don't know what her status is as a believer, but she was obviously raised in Christian country, and the main character is not no Christian. She has serial monogamy kind of things going on in each book. But she also has a little head where there's a preacher and a pragmatist, so whenever issues come up, they both, you know, try to convince her of that sort of... I mean, it's a plot device by which she manages to inject Christian... A Christian analysis of a situation. Her character doesn't always listen to that side of the thing, but it's there. And
yeah.
Undistorted, too, mm-hmm. by
some other questions, because Kathy can throw in... if you ask a question that goes along with what she's already meditated on, we can do it. Other questions?
I interrupt real good.
Somebody else?
Well, something I wanted to comment on, and I guess it's your second page here, is he says, Christians should be the most nuanced of cultural observers. And you said that we should neither, you know, praise the good stuff to the heavens nor trash the bad stuff. I mean, there's an awful lot of people who come into Redeemer from no church background, but there's a lot of people who come into Redeemer from a Bible background that has
right.
a very Manichaean world.
Yeah, at least a third.
In terms of good and evil.
And have to be deprogrammed.
No, but it's something that I struggle with a lot. And, I mean, I happen to have a vocation in which... I am allowed to do thumbs up and thumbs down, and it makes a big difference. And so, to a certain extent, I revel in that ability to do that.
To trash things?
Yeah.
But
because
it's
not the stuff needs to be trashed.
It's your job is different.
That's my role at Redeemer, though, Jill. No, anything that goes in print goes by me first, and it's meant. It's a quality control issue.
That's the difference. But you see, when you're talking about quality, that's not what. When I said trashing and praising, I really didn't. Yes, I'm. Thank you for catching me on this. But I was trying. I was talking about the content of it, not necessarily the excellence with which the content has gotten across. So that very very important. There's no doubt about it. And as Christians, there's a tendency, as we all know, to give a free ride to bad quality stuff that we think has a message we like. And to trash great quality stuff, which has a message we don't. And then you are standing against that, and that is a very non-Manichaean approach to say, I'm going to trash the bad stuff, regardless of its content. I'm going to praise the good stuff regardless of its content. Why? Because of my understanding, actually, of the creational good in everything. And also because I'm not a Manichaean and say, well, because this is a Christian book or it's overtly moral, I'm going to try to encourage it. You say no, I'm beyond that. So you see, it doesn't contradict.
Right.
But it helped me clarify. Thank you.
One of my things I'm just betting is your question, Jill. So since you're already speaking, I in my position at Barnes & Noble, I'm continually introducing new fiction writers.
Oh, right.
Okay.
All right. So as long as we're talking, can I read this one?
Mm-hmm.
As well as those of narrative nonfiction to the marketplace. But one of my biggest frustrations has been the number of solidly intellectual believers I run up against who eschew the very idea of fiction, especially fiction not deemed classic. It is as if they are earning literary points in heaven by tallying up the great works of literature they're reading rather than supporting the artistic efforts of their contemporaries. In my mind, the making of art is about one thing, and at its very foundation, the telling of truth. How can thinking Christians not believe there's merit in contemporary fiction, realize the story, or in his case, the parable, is how Christ actually revealed most of the truths in the gospel. I'm flummoxed by this and would love to hear what Tim has to say
Good
about
word.
The place of fiction and story in the practice of Christianity. Actually, he's talked about that all night. Clearly,
but.
These same Christians go to movies and watch television based on fictional themes, but fail to see the potential for good in contemporary fiction works. two answers to that. One is there's just plain old inconsistency. People are inconsistent, and reading a book takes more effort than watching TV or a movie. You have to actually grapple with the ideas that are being presented. The ideas are on the top, and the entertainment value on the movie or the TV thing is on the top, and the idea, if there is even an idea, is down lower. However, I also have to say something, because I have a great Dave. Tell me how to say this so I don't embarrass myself. David Mamet. It's not Mamet. Okay. I keep wanting to say Mamet and sound really like French.
Marmot. Okay. David Marmot.
I have to read a quote. This is an article that he wrote for
Little
Rolling
furry.
Stone
David.
Whenever Patrick O'Brien died. Patrick O'Brien, who wrote 20 of these wonderful sea novels. He says, let me tell you why I'm reading it. Inconsistency is one reason, but also there is an awful lot of very bad contemporary writing out there. Just bad stuff. And this is David Mamet, so I don't feel alone in thinking that. For the past 30 years, the greatest novelists writing in English have been genre writers. John le Carré, George Higgins, Patrick O'Brien. Each year, of course, the press finds some writer whose style, provenance, and choice of theme is endearing. These usually trig, slim tomes share a wistful and self-commendatory confusion at the multiplicity of life and stink of art. But without sentimentality, genre writers wrote without sentimentality. Their prose was concise and perceptive. In it, the reader sees the life of which they wrote, rather than the writer's technique. For to hell with this putrid and despicable graduate degree sensitivity. Le Carré had been a spy, Higgins was a working attorney and district attorney, and God knows what Patrick O'Brien had not been up to in his 80-plus years. And he goes into some other stuff, and I just want to read one last thing. The purpose of literature is to delight. To create or endorse the scholastic is a craven desire. It may yield a low-level self-satisfaction, but how can this compare with our joy at great, generous writing? With our joy of discovery of worth in the simple and straightforward. Shel Silverstein said that there were some authors whose books one literally wanted to hug to oneself with thanks and in unavailing protest that at some point the works had an end. And there's just not much of that stuff being written.
So are you saying to Jill, one problem, of course, is the great, it's just how uneven the quality of...
There's
modern fiction is. It's extremely uneven in quality.
In the same manner that you preach the gospel to a generation of people to whom freedom is the ultimate,
right.
Don't you think that in the same manner fiction writers, contemporary fiction writers are telling different stories?
Yeah.
That are having that at its core rather than the old narrative being a good life versus a free life?
Yeah, but I think Mehmet's saying something else. He's saying that there's a pretentiousness about modern writers that disdains the things that are accessible. This is a review of my very favorite set of historical novels, Dorothy Dunnett. Any of you familiar with Francis Crawford of Lyman? Whoa. Don't get started unless you've got a lot of time on your hands, because you will get sunk right in. Her first sentence is, "It is a truism that great novels have seldom been instant successes. Runaway best-selling acclaim tends to settle on the lowlier branches of the literary enterprise, like fantasy, mystery, or romance, whose virtue and defect is their accessibility." She finds accessibility a defect in writing. And I think what a lot of contemporary writers have made that same mistake and said, as long as I'm really opaque, very confusing, you know, James Joyce couldn't even read me and come away with a plot line, then I'm just really doing heavy-duty art.
That's an editing problem as well.
Well, yeah.
This is a bigger subject. But I mean,
if you don't know Dorothy
visual
Dunnett,
art,
come up and read this afterwards.
It's an interesting question about visual art, too. Yeah, is it true that 200 years ago, the elite artists were as far away from common sensibilities as they are now? I mean, there's a lot of discussion about that. That the visual artists right now are, and of course they disdain the fact that they know that almost nobody likes their stuff. That you have to be unbelievably educated in a very rarefied way to appreciate an awful lot of contemporary art. And I guess what Kathy's just trying to say, there does seem to be a certain amount of modern fiction that's the same way, and it's just it kind of it kind of uh,
and it might be an elitist, and I don't know if that quite fits in, but I think you are right that you have to open up the possibility that to do fiction as a Christian that works itself into postmodern stories, or lack thereof, you would have to do something that maybe a lot of people wouldn't like. It wouldn't be traditional. I agree. I think Kathy's just talking about something that's a little bit more along the lines of the problem of contemporary visual art right now. And there's such a huge disconnect between that and what most people find beautiful or helpful or meaningful.
But read John Ruskin on the Impressionists.
Yeah, it's different. No, you're right. You're right.
Tim was the other day that read me a review of a book. What's the name of the book?
What are you talking about? You mean the thing in Harper's?
Yeah, The Purpose-Driven Life, which some of you have read. And it was a non-Christian reviewing it, and it was a very fair review. It slammed the book where it deserved to be slammed, and it applauded it where it deserved to be applauded. And that's such a rarity to find someone of any conviction, you know, pro, con, you know, whatever their religious values are, who can be fair-minded. You want to give a guy a Pulitzer just for being, you know, objective, because objectivity... I have noticed, and some of you who are journalists maybe can correct me, is this journalism 101? I never took it. You can't have a straight storyline, no matter how many positive things you can say. You know, Mother Teresa was da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, but you picked your nose. You know, there has to be a balancing negative, because otherwise you look like you're writing a puff piece, you know. The woman was indescribably beautiful, but her pedicurist revealed that her toes were too thin. You know, there has to be this other side going on, you know, whether that's truly part of the story or not. Is this something that they teach in Journalism 101? You have to have...
Unless you write for a woman's magazine,
Well, it's meant to show that I'm a real objective investigative reporter.
Yeah,
but sometimes it just comes off silly, like with her toes are too thin. Okay. And I haven't been taking.
What's the bottom line?
Cynicism.
And it shows objectivity.
Yes, that's what I.
It's like I can prove I'm objective by telling you some balancing thing, even
right,
if it's not merited.
Everybody's on the take except me. And that's the reason why the postmodern deconstruction tool doesn't work, because you don't use it on yourself. Because if you did use it on yourself, you wouldn't be so cynical. You're not cynical about your cynicism, you know.
The humbleness, if you write about, let's say, some political leader you like.
Yeah.
But you know, other people don't see the objective truth in the way you do it. You need to, as a service to your reader, to let them know that there is another viewpoint there. And that's being humble and fair and honest to your reader. And yes, I've never experienced, the person that you write about never liked that. They never liked the little negative comments from other people who put in there with them. It's a general rule of thumb. You never get any gratitude for that. But it's an act of humbleness and honesty. Because probably you're doing the story because you really like, maybe you really like the person. But
you got to show there's other points of view.
Yeah.
Right.
Also, in the same way that a Christian perspective is more nuanced and can see both the good and the bad and the good, wouldn't a Christian reporter then be able to give that full panoply of one character and see all the facets that are there?
You should be able to.
Real, not fake. And that what the toes too thin thing is.
Yeah. But, you know, as you pointed out, no one ever likes to hear it.
Same thing with biography. Now, I know Abby's doing a biography, so... But, you know, it's very interesting. There was a... You know, an interesting... not that it's... They're pretty long, so it would be a lot of work, but an interesting exercise would be to read Arnold Dallimore's biography of George Whitefield, which is really a hagiography. It's a... You know, it's just... It's a very worshipful... a kind of biography of this great Anglican, you know, evangelist. And then read Harry Stout, who teaches at Yale, wrote a book called The Divine Dramatist, in which he went into newspaper accounts of Whitefield, and it was a much, much more warts and all portrait of Whitefield. Same thing is true. There's a biography written 15 years ago on Jonathan Edwards by a guy named Ian Murray. It's very well known in Christian circles. It's very worshipful about Jonathan Edwards. Now there's a new biography out by George Marsden, Yale University Press. Just came out. I just got it in the mail 2 days ago. And it's much more critical. But Marsden is a very strong Christian, graduate of Westminster Seminary. He teaches at Notre Dame, and he's very respected historian. But he's writing a kind of warts and all thing. And when Harry Stout got a lot of flack when he wrote his biography on Whitfield from Christians, who said, this is unfair, and this is a great man, you're just trying to drag him down the mud. And Harry Stout argued on theological grounds why I got to tell the truth. You know, and here's newspaper accounts that show that there are things that Whitfield probably did that were, you know, less than admirable. There was a lot of pride and arrogance as a young man. There was a lot of it, frankly, when he was in his 20s, and he was the first celebrity in the history, probably. If you wanted to define celebrity properly, and it went to his head, and he said an awful lot of awful things that come out in the newspapers that weren't in a lot of his biographies and all that sort of thing. But Harry Stout argued on the basis of the Christian worldview that, of course, these guys have got to be sinners. They have to be sinners. They have to be. And we've got to bring that out. So he argued on theological grounds for it, though he really didn't make many friends. Now, I'm only not trying to warn you about, but I mean, you know, joy isn't quite the same thing as our Jonathan Edwards. But if you read those biographies that are much more critical, yet they're incredibly respectful as well, you get it. Those guys who really have hit that balance as writers. Now, biography is another whole thing, but I'd say Harry Stout and George Marsden have done an excellent job, and they're arguing out of a Christian worldview, whereas the older biographies were almost not the result of a gospel worldview, but more of a traditional moralistic view. We have to have our heroes, and the heroes have to be practically perfect, because that's our job, to be practically perfect, then we'll go to heaven. I mean, that's the subtext there.
One more.
Sure. One more with the three hands.
Yeah.
What if I do like
most
1 minute
of the ones
on each?
That have been here have all been answered.
Okay, right here. Let me just do three. Yes, yes, sir.
Yeah, with film and television in the past, you know, 100 years, it's been replacing books so much. Do you think that will continue to replace books to the point where they're almost obsolete? Or do you think that it's a common?
Boy, you know, and I was going to give a short answer to these three. You know, I don't know who to believe, because there are pretty dire predictions about, you know, they're definitely, my own children, I know, don't read as well as we did, and it's not got anything to do with IQ. I don't know what it is, but there is some change happening. It doesn't look good, but I just can't imagine the word will go out, but it's. There is some kind of erosion of ability to read. It takes a lot of work, a lot of imagination, and we do live in more of an image culture that does your imagining for you. It's a problem.
Can I share my one quote, though? In Harlan Ellison, in the preface to Harlan Ellison's book, Strange Wine, he quotes Isaac Asimov about a new technology that Asimov saw coming down the line, which was a personal video set that would be activated when you looked at it and turn off when you looked away. It would be inaudible to everyone except you. It would go fast forward, back forward. You could, you know, portable, needs to know batteries. And he goes on to this lengthy description, and just when you're saying, gosh, where can I get one of them? He says, it's a hook.
However,
no, I don't think that technology is ever going to replace the battery-free personal recorder that is the book.
It's not all glum. Because a perfect example of this is Harry Potter. Enormous shock that so many kids are reading it. They're really long. They love it. And there's an almost universal agreement that kids like the movies, but they're nothing like the books. Everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. The movies have not been unbelievably over-the-top a success, especially the second one. I mean, the movies are flat. If you read the book and then you go to the movie, there's no way, even with J.K. Rowling, you know, haunting the movie, to make it almost too much of a retell of the book. Did I say Rowling? Rowling. Nevertheless, I mean, that's a great example of you're getting a bunch of kids who are reading. They see movies can't do quite what books do. So there's a lot of signs of hope. Yes, I'm sorry, going to be fast.
I'll try to be fast, too.
Sure.
The whole Tolkien versus Lewis thing, without being too overt about your allegories, but, you know, trying to disguise it. They talk about, you know, like, not going out and saying this is virtue and this is brokenness and this is good and this is bad, but starting with a good story and having it come out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Should that be our intentions? But what should our heroes look like? You know, we.
Tolkien would say that you should just try to write a story, and if you're a Christian, what happens is the story is affected at a subconscious level by the gospel that has penetrated your imagination. He says that's the most organic and natural way.
In fact, he used the word organic very deliberately. He said that the Christian themes in Lord of the Rings came out of a compost heap.
He calls it that.
Of his experience as a Christian.
And only when he went back and read it, he saw the kind of Christian imagery, but he never did it on purpose. Now, he added little touches. He said on the rewrite, he couldn't... I don't know, if you go to the very end of the book, and you see the appendix, and he created a kind of chronology of what day everybody left and all that, he had the Fellowship of the Ring leave on December 25th. And he had, the destruction of the ring on Mount Doom on March 25th. So in other words,
Easter.
Yeah, in other words, and he did that on purpose. But it was later touches where he threw it in as a reviser. But he says, I saw it as I revised it, but I really didn't see it as I was writing it. And that's one of the reasons why it's much more natural and organic, and it gets under the radar. All sorts of people that are very hostile to Christianity, they do not smell it, and it comes in under the radar. And he didn't do it for that reason. He says that's what good art will do. But he didn't try to disguise it. In fact, if you're trying to disguise it, it's not probably going to be disguised.
Yeah,